A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been dealing with a long-standing digestive issue since gallbladder surgery, and he's noticed something interesting about how doctors handle drug interactions. He was prescribed a low dose of amitriptyline on top of Lexapro, saw online that this combination supposedly carries a risk of serotonin syndrome, but his doctor had zero hesitation prescribing it, and he had no problems. So the real question is, how do clinicians actually manage drug-drug interactions in practice, beyond just checking a database? Do experienced practitioners develop a sense for which interactions actually matter? And are the databases themselves standardized globally, or does every country do its own thing?
This is one of those topics where the gap between what the computer says and what the doctor does is enormous. And that gap is where all the interesting stuff lives. Let's start with the amitriptyline and Lexapro example because it's a perfect case study. Yes, both drugs increase serotonin levels. Yes, in theory, combining them could cause serotonin syndrome. And yes, the database will flag it, probably with a bold red warning, maybe even a contraindication.
The doctor yawned and wrote the script.
And here's why. Amitriptyline for gut issues is typically prescribed at 10 to 25 milligrams. That's a tiny dose. For depression, you'd be looking at 100 to 150 milligrams. At that low dose, the serotonergic effect is minimal. It's mostly working on other receptors, which is why it helps with visceral hypersensitivity in the gut. Lexapro is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, so it's doing its thing. But the additive effect of that tiny amitriptyline dose is pharmacologically trivial. The doctor knows this. The database doesn't.
The database is a literalist. It sees two drugs with overlapping mechanisms and screams.
A database is the world's most anxious pharmacist. And that's not a criticism. It's designed to be exhaustive. But exhaustiveness in drug interaction screening produces a problem that's been studied pretty extensively.
The boy who cried drug interaction.
There was a landmark study back in 2012. Researchers looked at over 100,000 medication orders across several large hospitals. Clinicians overrode something like 90% of drug interaction alerts.
At that point, the alert isn't a safety feature. It's background noise.
The danger, of course, is that when a genuinely dangerous interaction does show up, it gets lost in the static. If your EHR is popping up warnings for every minor theoretical interaction, the doctor's brain learns to dismiss them reflexively. The researchers called it desensitization. The more alerts you see, the less you pay attention to any of them.
It's the TSA of medicine. When everything is a threat, nothing is.
That's actually a very good comparison. The TSA flags a bottle of water the same way it flags a weapon. The system doesn't distinguish severity well. And drug interaction databases have historically had the same problem. They're built for sensitivity. They want to catch everything. But specificity suffers terribly.
How do clinicians actually sort through this? You mentioned experienced doctors develop a sense for it. What's the mental model?
There are a few layers. First, clinicians learn to recognize the interactions that are dangerous, the ones where you don't mess around. Warfarin and certain antibiotics, for example. That combination can cause a massive spike in INR and lead to serious bleeding. Methotrexate and trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, that can cause bone marrow suppression. Those are the ones where the pharmacist will call the doctor and say, "We are not filling this until we talk."
The phone call tier.
The phone call tier. And it's a real tier. Pharmacists are the safety net here, and they're trained to triage. A community pharmacist might see 50 interaction flags in a day. They override most of them after a quick clinical judgment check. But two or three will trigger an actual conversation with the prescriber.
There's a hierarchy of concern that isn't visible to the patient. The patient just sees the internet saying serotonin syndrome risk and panics.
The internet is doing exactly what the database does, listing every possible interaction with no clinical waiting. A health forum doesn't tell you that the risk of serotonin syndrome from low-dose amitriptyline plus Lexapro is vanishingly small. It just says these drugs interact. Danger. And to be fair, the formal databases have gotten better at tiering. Most modern systems categorize interactions by severity, contraindicated, major, moderate, minor. But even major covers a huge range.
I remember reading about a classification system where major can mean anything from this will definitely kill you to monitor slightly more often.
That's essentially the problem. The most widely used drug interaction compendia, and this gets to the second part of the prompt about standardization, there are a handful of major ones. You've got Micromedex, which is part of IBM Watson Health now. You've got Lexicomp, which is owned by Wolters Kluwer. You've got the British National Formulary, which is the standard in the UK. You've got Stockley's Drug Interactions, which is the comprehensive reference text. And in the United States, many systems also pull from Drugs.com or Medscape's Interaction Checker, which license data from these larger databases.
There isn't one global standard. It's a marketplace.
It's a marketplace of compendia, and they don't always agree with each other. A study published a few years ago compared interaction classifications across four major databases, Micromedex, Lexicomp, the BNF, and Stockley's. For the same drug pair, the severity rating could differ by two levels. One database says major, another says moderate, and the doctor is left to figure out what that actually means for the patient in front of them.
Which is where clinical judgment enters the room.
Clinical judgment, patient-specific factors, and something that doesn't get talked about enough, the therapeutic context. The amitriptyline and Lexapro case illustrates this beautifully. The patient has a long-standing post-surgical digestive complaint that hasn't responded to conventional treatment. The gastroenterologist is trying to address visceral hypersensitivity. Low-dose amitriptyline is a well-established treatment for this. The Lexapro is managing something else, anxiety or depression. Discontinuing either one has consequences. The interaction risk, in context, is theoretical and manageable. The benefit of treating the gut issue is concrete and immediate.
The doctor is weighing a small theoretical risk against a known present benefit.
That's medicine. Every treatment decision is a risk-benefit calculation. The interaction database provides one input into that calculation. It's not the calculator itself.
What about the country-level question? Daniel mentioned he's in Israel now, and he's noticed differences in how the healthcare system handles this. Are Israeli doctors using different databases?
Israel is an interesting case. The Ministry of Health maintains its own drug formulary and provides guidance on prescribing, but in practice, the major electronic health record systems in Israel, the ones used by Clalit, Maccabi, Mohadet, Lomit, they license interaction data from the major international compendia, often Micromedex or Lexicomp. However, Israel also has its own adverse drug reaction reporting system and its own pharmacovigilance infrastructure.
The underlying data is global, but the implementation is local.
That local implementation matters a lot. Different EHR systems configure their alert thresholds differently. One system might set the bar for a pop-up alert at moderate severity. Another might only interrupt the workflow for major or contraindicated. The same drug combination could trigger a disruptive alert in one clinic and a silent note in another. The doctor's experience of interaction checking is shaped as much by the software configuration as by the underlying database.
Which means two equally competent doctors in different systems might have different awareness of the same interaction.
That's before we even get to the question of how different countries regulate this. The FDA in the United States requires drug interaction data as part of the new drug application process. The European Medicines Agency has its own requirements. Japan's PMDA has its own. A drug approved in all three jurisdictions might have slightly different interaction labeling in each one, because the clinical trials were conducted on different populations and the regulators emphasized different things.
The interaction isn't a fixed property of the two molecules. It's partly a regulatory artifact.
The pharmacokinetics are fixed. If drug A inhibits the CYP3A4 enzyme and drug B is metabolized by CYP3A4, that's true in every country. But whether that interaction is classified as major or moderate, whether it triggers a hard stop or a soft warning, whether the label says contraindicated or use with caution, that varies.
Let's talk about the enzyme piece, because that's where a lot of the real action is. You mentioned CYP3A4. How much of interaction checking is just knowing the cytochrome P450 system?
A substantial portion. The CYP4TF enzymes, especially 3A4, 2D6, 2C9, 2C19, and 1A2, are responsible for metabolizing something like 70 to 80% of all clinically used drugs. If you know which drugs are substrates, inhibitors, and inducers of each enzyme, you can predict a huge number of interactions without ever opening a database.
Substrates, inhibitors, inducers. Break that down.
A substrate is a drug that gets broken down by a particular enzyme. An inhibitor is a drug that slows down that enzyme. An inducer is a drug that speeds up that enzyme. So, if you give a substrate plus an inhibitor, the substrate builds up to potentially toxic levels because it's not being cleared. If you give a substrate plus an inducer, the substrate gets cleared too fast and might not reach therapeutic levels.
The amitriptyline and lexaprocase. What's happening there at the enzyme level?
Lexapro, or escitalopram, is metabolized by several CYP enzymes, 2C19, 3A4, and 2D6. Amitriptyline is metabolized primarily by 2D6 and 2C19. Lexapro is actually a mild inhibitor of 2D6, so in theory it could slightly increase amitriptyline levels. But at the low doses we're talking about for gut treatment, the clinical significance is negligible. The serotonin syndrome concern isn't primarily enzymatic, it's pharmacodynamic. Both drugs increase serotonin signaling, just through slightly different mechanisms. The additive effect at these doses is not clinically meaningful.
The doctor runs this mental calculation, low dose, mild inhibition, additive effect minimal, and concludes it's fine. The database just sees two serotonergic drugs and panics.
This is why experienced clinicians develop what looks like intuition, but is actually pattern recognition built on thousands of cases. They've seen the amitriptyline-Lexapro combination prescribed hundreds of times. They've never seen a case of serotonin syndrome from it at these doses. Their mental Bayesian prior is very strong.
The database has no Bayesian prior. It's a frequentist in a Bayesian world.
That's a very corn way to put it. But yes, exactly. The database treats every interaction as if it's being evaluated for the first time, with no accumulated clinical experience. The doctor has a mental model that incorporates prevalence, severity, dose dependence, and patient-specific factors.
What are the interactions that actually scare doctors? The ones where the Bayesian prior says, "Do not do this."
There's a relatively short list of interactions that are dangerous and relatively common. I mentioned warfarin and certain antibiotics, particularly trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole, metronidazole, and fluconazole. Those can cause dramatic INR elevation and serious bleeding. Another one is clopidogrel and omeprazole. Omeprazole inhibits the enzyme that activates clopidogrel, potentially reducing its antiplatelet effect. That one's been debated extensively, but most clinicians avoid the combination.
The heartburn drug cancels out the heart attack drug.
In simplified terms, yes. Another big one is statins and certain CYP3A4 inhibitors. Simvastatin or atorvastatin with clarithromycin or certain antifungals that can cause rhabdomyolysis, which is muscle breakdown that can lead to kidney failure. Lithium and NSAIDs. The NSAIDs can increase lithium levels to toxic ranges. Methotrexate and NSAIDs, that combination can reduce methotrexate clearance and cause severe bone marrow suppression.
These are the ones where the pharmacist calls.
These are the ones where the pharmacist calls, and often the system is configured to put up a hard stop. A hard stop means the order cannot be placed without an override reason, and some systems require a co-signature. That's different from a soft alert, which you can click through with one button.
How are those thresholds decided? Who decides that this interaction gets a hard stop, and that one gets a soft alert?
That's a fascinating question. In hospital systems, it's typically a pharmacy and therapeutics committee, a group of physicians and pharmacists who review the evidence and configure the alert logic. They're making judgment calls about which interactions pose enough risk to justify interrupting the prescriber's workflow, and those judgment calls vary between institutions. One hospital might put a hard stop on the clopidogrel-omeprazole interaction. Another might leave it as a soft alert with a note about using pantoprazole as an alternative.
Even within the same country, using the same database, two hospitals might have different alert configurations.
The same is true across countries, but with an additional layer of regulatory divergence. Some countries have national formularies that include interaction guidance. The British National Formulary, for example, includes interaction classifications that are specifically written for UK prescribing practice. Sweden has a national interaction database called Janismed. The Netherlands has the G-Standard, which includes interaction monitoring as part of the national drug database used by all pharmacies. Israel's Ministry of Health publishes a national drug formulary, but the interaction checking in day-to-day practice is driven by the EHR systems, which, as I mentioned, license international data. The interesting thing about Israel is that the four health maintenance organizations, Clalit, Maccabi, Mohedet, Lumit, each have their own integrated electronic health record, and they each configure their clinical decision support independently. So a Clalit doctor and a Maccabi doctor might see different alerts for the same drug combination, even though they're practicing in the same city.
That's surprisingly fragmented for a system that's otherwise quite centralized.
It's a consequence of the HMO structure. Each HMO is responsible for its own IT infrastructure. They all use electronic health records, but they're different platforms with different configurations. Clalit's system is different from Maccabi's. The Ministry of Health provides oversight, but the day-to-day alert logic is set at the HMO level.
Daniel's experience, feeling like the system handles interactions differently than what he reads online. That's partly the Israeli HMO configuration, partly the universal gap between database logic and clinical judgment.
Partly the difference between how patients and clinicians think about risk. A patient reads risk of serotonin syndrome and imagines a meaningful probability. A clinician reads the same warning and thinks, I've prescribed this combination hundreds of times and never seen serotonin syndrome from it. The clinician's risk estimate is calibrated by experience. The patient's risk estimate is calibrated by the worst case scenario.
The patient is reading the label. The doctor is reading the patient.
The label, by design, errs on the side of caution. Drug labels are legal documents as much as medical ones. The manufacturer lists interactions to limit liability. If there's a single case report of an adverse event from a drug combination, it might end up in the label. That's appropriate from a regulatory standpoint, but it creates a misleading picture of actual clinical risk.
The legal CYA effect.
And it's not just drug labels. The interaction databases themselves are conservative. If there's a plausible mechanism for an interaction and some case reports, it'll be listed. The database vendors also have liability concerns. They'd rather flag too many interactions than miss one that causes harm.
We've got manufacturers being conservative, database vendors being conservative, and regulators being conservative. By the time the alert reaches the doctor, it's been through three layers of liability protection.
The doctor is the first person in the chain whose primary concern is actually treating the patient rather than avoiding lawsuits. That's not to say doctors don't care about liability, they absolutely do. But their professional obligation is to weigh risks and benefits for the specific patient, not to treat every theoretical risk as a contraindication.
This connects to something Daniel mentioned. He said he's more likely to discuss health issues with AI tools than with Google. And I think there's an interesting parallel here. An AI, if it's well-trained, might actually do a better job of contextualizing interactions than a static database. It can incorporate dose, patient history, and clinical context in a way that a simple interaction checker can't.
There's active research on this. Large language models are being evaluated for drug interaction screening, and the early results are mixed. The models can capture clinical nuance that rigid databases miss, but they also hallucinate interactions that don't exist. A study from late 2025 looked at several major LLMs and found that they correctly identified known serious interactions about 80% of the time, but they also flagged false interactions about 15% of the time.
That 15% is the problem. A database might be overly conservative, but at least it's consistently conservative. An AI that invents interactions out of nowhere is a different kind of dangerous.
There's a subtler issue. Even when the AI gets the interaction right, its explanation might be wrong. It might correctly say, this combination increases bleeding risk, but attribute it to the wrong mechanism. If a clinician trusts the explanation and uses it to reason about related drug combinations, they could make errors that cascade.
The hallucinated mechanism problem.
The database says major interaction mechanism is CYP3A4 inhibition, and that's sourced from published pharmacokinetic studies. The AI might say the same thing, but have invented the mechanism. The output looks identical, but the provenance is completely different.
Where does that leave the patient who's using AI as a health resource? Daniel said he's more comfortable discussing things with AI tools. Is that a good thing?
It depends on what he's using them for. If he's using AI to understand why his doctor prescribed a combination that looks dangerous online, and the AI explains the clinical reasoning, the dose dependence, the risk-benefit calculus, that could actually reduce anxiety and improve adherence. If he's using AI to check interactions independently and make his own prescribing decisions, that's a different story.
The AI as explainer versus AI as prescriber.
And the explainer role is valuable. One of the problems with the current system is that patients see an interaction warning online, panic, and either stop their medication without consulting their doctor, or they go into the appointment anxious and mistrustful. A well-designed AI tool could bridge that gap, explain why the doctor made the decision they did, put the risk in context, and recommend a conversation with the prescriber rather than unilateral action.
The AI, as the calm pharmacist who actually has time to explain things,
which is a role that community pharmacists used to play more often, before they were drowning in prescription volume and administrative burden. The pharmacist is supposed to be the accessible expert who can explain interactions to patients. But in practice, many patients never have that conversation.
Because the pharmacist is too busy counting pills and fighting with insurance companies.
The doctor is too busy to explain the clinical reasoning behind every prescribing decision. So the patient Googles the interaction, finds the scariest possible interpretation, and loses trust in the whole process. It's a systemic failure of communication, not a failure of medical judgment.
Let's circle back to the standardization question, because I think there's a deeper point here about why countries differ. You mentioned that the databases are global, but the implementation is local. But there's also a pharmacogenetic dimension, right? Different populations have different distributions of CYP450 variants.
That's a crucial point. The activity of CYP enzymes varies significantly across populations. For example, CYP2D6, which metabolizes amitriptyline, among many other drugs, has a well-known polymorphism distribution. About 7 to 10% of Caucasians are poor metabolizers, meaning they have very low enzyme activity, but that number is much lower in East Asian populations, around 1 to 2%. Conversely, certain CYP2C19 variants that reduce enzyme activity are more common in East Asian populations, up to 20%, compared to about 3 to 5% in Caucasians.
The same drug combination might be riskier in one population than another, purely because of genetic differences in how the drugs are metabolized.
And most interaction databases don't account for this at all. They treat the interaction as a fixed property of the two molecules, independent of the patient's genetics. But if you're a poor CYP2D6 metabolizer, a drug that inhibits CYP2D6 won't affect you much. Your enzyme activity is already so low that inhibition doesn't change anything. If you're an ultra-rapid metabolizer, the same inhibitor could have a dramatic effect.
We're layering genetic variation on top of dose variation, on top of database variation, on top of regulatory variation.
This is why clinical judgment isn't just a nice to have. It's the only thing that can integrate all of these factors. The database gives you a starting point. These two drugs interact via this mechanism. The clinician then asks, what dose, what patient, what genetics, what therapeutic alternatives, what's the risk-benefit trade-off? No database can answer all of those questions simultaneously.
Is there any movement toward incorporating pharmacogenetics into interaction checking?
There is, but it's slow. Some academic medical centers are piloting systems that integrate pharmacogenetic data into clinical decision support. If the patient has been genotyped for CYP variants, the interaction alert can be personalized. This interaction is major for most patients, but your CYP2D6 genotype suggests you're a poor metabolizer, so the clinical significance is reduced. That's the future, but we're a long way from it being standard practice.
That's before we even get to the polypharmacy problem. When someone is on 5, 6, 7 drugs, the interaction possibilities multiply combinatorially. No database can fully characterize the net effect.
This is where it gets impossible to systematize. 2 drug interactions are well characterized. 3 drug interactions are poorly characterized. 4 or more, and you're in uncharted territory. The databases mostly only handle pairwise interactions. They'll flag drug A plus drug B and drug A plus drug C, but they won't tell you what happens when the patient is taking all three simultaneously.
The system sees a series of pairs. The patient's body sees a soup.
A soup with multiple ingredients interacting in ways that no clinical trial has ever studied. And this is where experienced clinicians develop what looks almost like instinct. They've seen enough patients on similar combinations to have a sense of what's likely to cause problems. They know that adding one more serotonergic drug to an elderly patient on multiple medications is different from adding it to a young patient on just one other drug.
The geriatric polypharmacy problem is its own entire category of concern.
It's one where the interaction databases are least helpful, because the elderly patient is often on 8 or 10 medications, many of them for chronic conditions, and the interactions are not just drug-drug, but drug-disease. A drug that's fine for a young person might be problematic for someone with reduced renal function, even if there's no flagged interaction with their other medications.
Drug-disease interactions.
Another layer that most basic interaction checkers don't handle well. The better ones incorporate some drug disease logic. They'll flag that metformin should be used with caution in renal impairment, or that NSAIDs are relatively contraindicated in heart failure. But again, the integration of drug-drug and drug-disease interactions is where clinical judgment becomes indispensable.
To synthesize what we've covered, the databases are global, with a handful of major compendia that most countries license. The implementation is local, with different EHR systems, different alert thresholds, different regulatory overlays. The interpretation is individual, with clinicians using experience to filter out noise and focus on the interactions that actually matter. And the whole system is optimized for sensitivity at the expense of specificity, which is why alert fatigue is such a persistent problem.
That's a good summary. The one thing I'd add is that the pharmacist's role in this ecosystem is underappreciated. In community pharmacy, the pharmacist is often the last line of defense. They see the full medication list, they know which interactions are clinically significant, and they have the training to make those judgment calls. In many countries, including Israel, pharmacists have been given expanded scope of practice in recent years. They can adjust doses, extend prescriptions, and in some cases initiate therapy. Their role in interaction management is only growing.
Yet the patient rarely has a substantive conversation with the pharmacist about interactions, because the system isn't set up for it.
The system is set up for throughput. Get the prescription, fill the prescription, move to the next patient. The consultation window at the pharmacy counter is not designed for a 5-minute conversation about CYP450 enzymes.
The consultation window is designed for signing a clipboard and swiping a credit card.
That's a loss, because pharmacists are the most accessible health professionals in many communities. You don't need an appointment. You can walk in and ask a question. But the physical layout and workflow of most pharmacies don't encourage that kind of interaction.
Which brings us back to the AI point. If the pharmacist doesn't have time to explain, and the doctor doesn't have time to explain, and the internet is a panic generator, an AI that can provide accurate, contextualized information about drug interactions fills a genuine gap.
With the caveat we discussed, the hallucination problem, but I think the trajectory is clear. Within a few years, we'll have AI systems that are better than static databases at contextualizing interactions, and better than the internet at not causing unnecessary panic. The question is whether they'll be integrated into clinical workflows or remain consumer-facing tools.
Or both, with different standards for each.
Almost certainly both. The consumer version will be conservative and will always recommend consulting a healthcare provider. The clinical version will be integrated into EHR systems and will replace or augment the current rule-based alert logic. And hopefully it will reduce alert fatigue rather than making it worse.
One thing we haven't touched on, Daniel mentioned his digestive issue hasn't yielded to conventional treatment. That's the context in which the amitriptyline was prescribed. And it raises an interesting question about how the treatment refractory patient changes the risk calculus.
That's an excellent point. When a patient has failed first-line and second-line treatments, the risk-benefit calculation shifts. The doctor is more willing to try combinations that carry some theoretical risk because the alternative is leaving the patient with an untreated condition that's reducing their quality of life. The amitriptyline-Lexapro combination might raise an eyebrow if it were prescribed for a patient with mild, treatment-naive depression. but for a post-surgical digestive disorder that hasn't responded to anything else, the calculus is completely different.
The database doesn't know the patient has failed 3 other treatments.
The database doesn't know anything about the patient. It knows 2 drug names, and it outputs an interaction classification. That's the fundamental limitation, and it's why the doctor's role isn't going away. The doctor is the one who knows that this particular patient has been suffering for years, that conventional options are exhausted, that the low-dose amitriptyline is a reasonable next step, and that the Lexapro interaction risk is manageable.
It's almost like the interaction check is a starting point for a conversation, not an answer.
That's exactly what it should be. The best clinicians treat it that way. The interaction alert says, pay attention to this. It doesn't say, don't do this. The distinction is subtle but crucial. And learning which alerts to pay attention to, that's the craft of medicine.
The craft of medicine, as opposed to the database of medicine.
Both are necessary. You need the database because no clinician can memorize every possible interaction. But you also need the craft because the database can't tell you what matters for this patient, right now.
If I'm a patient and I see a scary interaction warning online, what should I do?
First, don't stop your medication without talking to your prescriber. Abrupt discontinuation can be dangerous in its own right. Second, ask your doctor or pharmacist to explain the interaction, not just whether it exists, but what the actual risk is in your specific case, at your specific doses. A good clinician can walk you through the reasoning. Third, be aware that online interaction checkers, including the reputable ones, are designed to flag everything. A flagged interaction is not the same as a dangerous interaction.
If the doctor seems unconcerned, that's probably not negligence. It's probably clinical judgment.
In the vast majority of cases, yes. The doctor has seen this combination before, knows the dose dependence, and has made a considered decision. If you're still concerned after the conversation, get a second opinion. But don't assume the database is right and the doctor is wrong. The database is a tool. The doctor is the one using it.
We've covered the databases. The alert fatigue, the enzyme systems, the country-level differences, the pharmacogenetics, the AI angle, and the clinical judgment piece. I think we've done justice to the prompt.
There's one more thing worth mentioning. The World Health Organization has a program for international drug monitoring that collects adverse drug reaction reports from over 150 countries. It's called the Uppsala Monitoring Center, and it maintains Vigibase, which is the largest global database of individual case safety reports. That's a different kind of database than the Interaction Compendia. It's post-market surveillance rather than prospective interaction prediction. But it's a global resource that feeds back into how countries assess drug safety, including interactions.
There is a global layer, but it's about collecting reports of harm after the fact, not about standardizing interaction checking at the point of care.
The global infrastructure for pharmacovigilance is relatively well developed. The global standardization of interaction checking at the clinical level is not. And maybe that's appropriate, given the local differences in prescribing patterns, population genetics, and healthcare system design.
The interaction is global. The interpretation is local. The decision is individual.
That's the episode, right there. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, European explorers encountering Tasmanian languages for the first time were baffled to discover that a single word could contain what would require an entire sentence in English, a feature of polysynthetic morphology. But what nobody anticipated was that this linguistic density would make inuktitut, a language spoken thousands of miles away in the Arctic, nearly impossible to accurately subtitle in real-time television broadcasts 4 centuries later, because the word order embeds the object inside the verb in a way that standard subtitle engines cannot chunk.
Right. The takeaway from all of this, drug interactions are real, but the way we're alerted to them is a mess of overcautious databases, underconfigured software, and alert-fatigued clinicians. The system works because experienced doctors and pharmacists know which alerts to ignore and which ones to act on. But that expertise isn't well communicated to patients, which is why so many people end up panicking over combinations that are clinically unremarkable. The fix isn't a better database, it's better communication, and maybe better AI tools that can explain the nuance rather than just flagging the risk.
If you're a patient wondering about an interaction you saw online, ask your pharmacist. They know more about this than anyone, and they're easier to access than you think.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.